Ars Electronica 2009 Human Nature Podcast.
So the first award of distinction has been given, and I'm very pleased to welcome Steve Lambert, because we cannot probably welcome them all, which is a problem right now here, because we have awarded the New York Times Special Edition project that Steve is going to talk about for the next 20 minutes. And we found that this highly perversive intervention draws attention to the underbelly of the US-American devotion to the idea that heroic politicians will save the world. And the New York Times Special Edition, in a certain sense, initiated by Steve Lambert, is a complex, collaborative, nine-month project edited, you will correct me if I'm wrong, by over 30 writers, distributed by hundreds of volunteers, and the design and printing of this new or special edition distributed to many cities in November 12, 2008, were nearly indistinguishable from the original New York Times like you know it, the real paper, the real printing, and you have probably brought one, did you?
What's that?
Did you bring one?
No.
Okay.
But they're in the, okay, fine.
Okay, anyway, so we had hypothetical headlines such as Iraq War Ends, or USA Patriot Act Repealed, or New York Bypass System Expanded Dramatically, which is really... Okay, the authority effects, indeed, that was granted by this paper was also produced by the absence of totally irrational idealism or utopian rhetoric. And by perfect timing, because the fake paper, in fact, dated July 2009, was distributed 1 week after the election of Barack Obama, thus presenting the world as it could be in 9 months. So we are meeting up very soon. And given giving ultra-national objectives and sufficient political motivation. So please welcome Steve Lambert. You mentioned that you're not the only one in the project, so we have some space, some dots. And yes. I think the list that you sent to Ars Electronica, it was, I don't know, it was hundreds of people,
yes.
But it was a very long list. So thank you for representing them all here.
So thank you all for coming, being in this dark room, and thanks for having me here. Thank you to Ars, really, we were flattered by this. So I'm going to tell you part of the story of how the special edition happened and the things that people ask me the most. And there'll be things I miss, but I'll be here till Tuesday. So the special edition started in a bar. I was in a bar with Steve Duncombe, who wrote this book, Dream, Reimagining Progressive Politics in an Age of Fantasy. He's an NYU professor. We were hanging out. Also there was Andrew Boyd, who is the founder of Billionaires for Bush, who would campaign for George Bush in the guise of billionaires in the 2004 election with some very hilarious signs, and Larry Bogat. Larry started the clandestine insurgent rebel clown army, who would go to protests dressed like clowns and go up to the front line where all the police were. And either the police would get pictures, or the press would get pictures of the police defending the public from clowns, or they would get pictures of the police beating up clowns. And either way, it was the advantage clown. Steve Duncombe was asking me what I was thinking about doing for the DNC, the Democratic National Committee meeting where Obama was decided as the candidate. Now, this is not an image of Las Vegas up here. This is the DNC. It's a massive spectacle. And there's a history that goes back. This is Chicago in 1968, outside the DNC. And so, you know, there's this meeting inside, and then there's protests and arrests outside. This is both Republican and Democratic committees meetings as these happen. And there's a history of, you know, our form of protest, at least in the U.S., which I know the best, and our methods haven't changed that much. We go out, we march, and we say no. We say don't, and we say not, and we say what we don't want, and then we get arrested. And then we just repeat it over and over again. So in 1968, we did it, and then there was a thing for the DNC was recreate 68, The whole world is watching. Go to Denver. Go get arrested. And so we keep doing this. The police adapt. The government adapts. They create these free speech zones that, you know, pen people in. This is an actual place where you were allowed to protest in the 2004 election. This is a real photo. Of course, began to ask why. Why are we doing the same things that we did 40 years ago? Why does it protest have to feel like an obligation, like you have to go out and do this thing? Most people feel like it's not effective. Although it is a great display, I don't want to discount it, but you know, we could do better. And why can't it be more fun? And why can't it maybe even be funny? So when Steve asked me what I was thinking about doing for the DNC, I suggested we have a parade. A parade with marching bands and parachuters, and they would, you know, play, and there would be a big celebration at the end of the war, and there would be lasers, and like I said, this meeting happened at a bar, and we got, you know, the idea sort of ran a little bit wild. But later on, you know, we talked about this for a little bit. I was at another bar with Andy Bickelbaum. Andy is one of the two main people in the Yes Men. And he said, you know, there's this protest coming up in D.C. Everyone's going to go. They're all going to get arrested. Do you want to go? And I said, no. Let's have a parade. And so Andy and I started talking about this. And when Andy and I get together, you know, it's like really easy for ideas to develop really quickly. And so for months, we took off with the idea of the parade. And we were planning this gigantic parade that would celebrate the end of the war. There would be pirate radio. We were going to recreate the White House press office and make videos from there with generals that were explaining how the withdrawal was going to happen, shoot video, create this massive hoax that we called the end of the War of the Worlds. And we worked on that for a long time. And that's how the newspaper came out. The newspaper was going to be a prop in this action. And we were going to make three of them. And it was going to be one page, and we would hold it over a regular newspaper and take pictures with it so our parade would look more legitimate. And as we started planning the parade, I started to figure out the logistics of it and how it was just going to end up looking like this. We were just going to get clobbered. It was going to be a cop magnet, especially after the RNC, the Republican National Convention, happened. They were just like, they were sweeping people up before they even got started. So, on top of that, the newspaper just seemed like a much better idea. And so we started working on the newspaper, and the parade sort of morphed into focusing just on this newspaper. It became the New York Times. It became a 14-page paper instead of one sheet, and we immediately started looking for help for other organizations and other people that could contribute to it, because I want to say this as much as possible. There's no way that two people can do this. It took a huge group. We recruited political groups, we recruited writers, we recruited designers, anyone that we thought that could help get involved. I'm representing all those people today. And Andy and I just kind of steered it and kept it on track. We kept it on track. We used wikis to author everything. So anyone could kind of contribute to writing a story. Anyone could edit a story. And then that's how they would get developed. So we don't really know who wrote what. How many authors contributed to what things, it was kind of a free-for-all. But we set sort of parameters for tone. So the idea was like, you know, this is the news, that's the best case scenario. Everything should be realistic. It can be funny, but it needs to be sincere. You need to be able to say, I want this to happen. There's a very famous newspaper in New York, in the United States called The Onion. And The Onion is sarcastic and funny, very funny. We want it to be sincere and funny. That was very important. So once people understood that, we got the paper going. We had to print it. I was telling earlier that we had a bunch of printers back out as soon as they figured out what we were trying to pay them to print. We were offering, you know, American money, and they turned us down because they thought that the content was too dangerous. We went through dozens of printers until we found one. So anyway, skipping ahead several months, we had these truckloads of newspapers. Officially, we told the press that we printed 1.2 million papers, which I'm still surprised they ever believed. We printed 80,000, which is still a massive amount for New York City. And this is the night before, as we handed out the papers. We had a 1,200 people on text alerts and a mailing list of people that wanted to take part in it. So we would just send messages, tell them where to pick up papers and what to do. They didn't know what they were getting, so they showed up and were handed this stack of newspapers, which the reactions were amazing. But anyway, looking at these pictures, it's like I still really can't believe that we pulled this off. So this was us figuring out the logistics and getting everyone coordinated to different places in the city. And then the next day, we had aprons, we had newspapers, and we began handing them out. So there's the paper. The goal that we talked about was that we wanted people for 15 seconds to believe that the war might have ended and some of these things could have happened, just to feel it. For after 7 years of being involved in this war, what it would to be reminded of what it was like to not have that be happening. And we knew that after about 15 seconds, there were enough clues that all these good things couldn't happen overnight. The date was 9 months in the future, that it was free. The Times doesn't give away free newspapers. That people would figure out, you know, they're smart enough to figure out what was going on. And most of them really enjoyed it. I actually have some video of
this
that.
This is amazing. I know it's fake, but it's amazing.
Oh, it is possible to be true. Of course it is. Unfortunately, we have a real chance now that it may come true.
I see. Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
What?
Good. Sounds great. It's just wonderful. Yeah. That's fantastic. I think we're in Camelot.
I think it's possible if you believe. If you believe in that and try to make it, I think it's possible.
So do you think it's possible to make it?
Yeah, I think it's possible to make it.
Why do people hate each other? Why do people kill each other? It's disgusting. We should all love each other. Have a wonderful day, darling.
I mean, that's be like a bowl full of my best case scenarios for this country, man. I wish it happens.
Instead of like wasting money on the war and stuff, they can like put money into college funds and for like donations of students that don't have enough money.
This is too good to be true, but it's not impossible.
Right, you can imagine.
That's great news.
Yeah.
It's really good news. It's about time they come home.
It's like real home. It's spent some money in this country with our economy, right?
These are, I'll just show you a couple other ones. There's a one of the guys, yeah.
It says all the new people.
All right, so we also made a website, which, this got us in the most trouble, actually. I'm proud to say this was made in WordPress, open source software. We really worked WordPress. Greg Osofsky and a team of people did that. We had 300,000 visitors in the first couple days, and those numbers are low because it killed our servers. We had about five people working to keep the servers up. We were asked to go on CNN in the couple days after, the next day. And I went with Andy and some other people that were keeping us calm. And we were totally expecting hostility from them and to sort of talk about all the legal issues. But the hosts seemed to love it. We didn't know that until basically about a minute before we went on. She was like, this is so great. You'll see her in a sec. She's crazy. But all the media that we talked to basically loved it, and it's traveled around the world. It was on the evening news in Germany. It was in newspapers in Mexico on the front page. We were in a major magazine in Russia. This we didn't expect. Now it seems like it makes sense, but at the time we didn't expect it at all. So, and we were on evening news like around the U.S. in every big city, and then every sort of smaller city too. So this is. the CNN appearance, which I'll just show you.
Andy Bickelbaum, one of the leading members of the group Yes Men that pulled off this prank, and Steve Lambert, a senior fellow at the iBeam Center for Art and Technology, who also played a part in pulling off this hoax. First of all, let's start with you, Andy. How did you pull this off? You printed up more than a million copies of this faux paper with the help of thousands of volunteers. How'd you do it?
Well, we wanted to do it. There's a tremendous desire to see.
That's my favorite thing is, how did you do it? Well, we wanted to do it, which is basically true. I mean, there was just a point where we're like, we're going to do this. We'll just figure out a way. We had no money. We worked for months with no money. We ended up getting donations from mailing lists, mostly in the amount of $20 to $100, and raised $11,000 that way when we were able to cover everything. This new thing is pretty funny, but we can look at that some other time. But yeah, I mean, a lot of it was really just sticking to it at points when it seemed really difficult. I joke around, well, it's true, I would get sick working on this, just thinking about all the bad things that could happen. I had nightmares about writing checks to the New York Times. Anyway, so there are a lot of people asking me, what about the law? What about the law with this project? So there were no arrests. Obviously, luckily in the US, we can still distribute a newspaper in the streets, and our constitution pretty much covers that. Andy, if you know him at all, is totally reckless. The Yes Men have had little to no consequences for all the pranks that they've pulled and all the stunts. They right now are in the middle of a lawsuit with Exxon, and they are suing Exxon. This is where they're at. So Andy was always, you know, like pushing for these extremes. Now I also have stayed out of trouble in the things that I've done, but more through planning and being very cautious and setting everything up so I can negotiate a path where no one can touch me, you know. And so us combined, it balanced out very well. We looked a little bit at what happened in the past with other. There were a few other fake New York Times that we heard about. This is one that was done by ACT UP, AIDS activist group called the New York Crimes. It was done in the 80s. There was one that was done in the 70s by the publishers, the printers union of the Times, who were really angry because they were on strike and made a fake issue and distributed it. Like everyone worked with them and put it out. We also learned about a Belgian paper during the Nazi occupation. Printers there made a newspaper that announced the end of the war and got it distributed on the streets. The Nazis didn't like this. They went after everyone involved in the newspaper industry and killed about 70% of them, thousands and thousands of people because of this. When we learned about this, this caused more nightmares for me. I knew that we wouldn't be murdered, but the idea that someone would murder a bunch of people for making a newspaper that announced the end of the war is just too similar not to haunt a guy. So anyway, afterwards, none of that happened. We weren't murdered, but we did get letters like this. This is from HSBC Bank, addressed to the New York Times Company, which was kind of strange. Asking us to remove a parody ad that we did on our website. They didn't seem to care about the newspaper. We got a similar letter from De Beers, the diamond company. And this was because we made this ad. It says, diamonds, you know it, we know it. Your purchase of a diamond between now and 96, I can't remember, will help fund the creation, fitting, and maintenance of a prosthetic for an African whose hand was lost in that nation's brutal conflicts over diamonds, or that continent's brutal conflicts over diamonds. De Beers from her fingers to his. This was, I wrote this ad, and I was very proud that it pissed De Beers off so much. They wanted our website gone, and they tried to intimidate our domain registrar. Luckily, we had support from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who humiliated De Beers on the front of their website and sent them a letter, and we never heard from De Beers again. The New York Times also threatened to sue us for copyright, and they wanted the domain. They wanted the website gone as well. Now, that's not to say that people at the Times didn't like it. When we were outside the Times handing out the paper, they were rushing down the stairs trying to get copies, and most of the writers that wrote about it said very good things. Their lawyers, though, tried to sue us. And the EFF wrote them back, shamed them, and we never heard from them again. So the result was zero lawsuits. We basically got away scot-free. And I'm very proud of that. You know, part of these lawsuits is to intimidate people from doing this kind of thing, so I want to encourage you to do this kind of thing. Another goal of ours was to kind of change the tone of activism, as I talked about before. This dream book that Steve Duncombe wrote outlines a lot of different ideas of an ethical spectacle. A spectacle that's transparent, that people can engage in and explore instead of just observing, and speaks in a language that people understand. So we were testing out a lot of these ideas. And Steve Duncombe actually wrote some of the ads in the paper and worked on it. And it seemed to work well. There was a fake Die Zeit that came out a few months after the Times that I think this says there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and it had all this best case scenario news modeled after our paper. A few months later, there was a fake Financial Times. It was a little bit more bitter, but that's okay. And that was distributed around England. Even Intel made an ad that was a fake New York Times that had their best case scenario news. Intel, the microchip manufacturer. And some of the people that worked on the Times got involved in making a fake International Herald Tribune for this upcoming climate conference in Copenhagen. It was distributed around Copenhagen. We worked with Greenpeace on that. There are others that are coming. I can't really tell you when or where. They're in multiple countries. We know of people that are working on these things, and some of us are working on them too. We're hoping that the concept can be improved on and built upon, and not only just take the shape of a newspaper, but the idea of an alternate vision of the way that the world can work that's written in a way that people can understand. So that is the New York Times special edition. I'm sure I'm leaving things out. There's the website there and my website, and please feel free to ask me any questions. Thank you.
Fine. So you created a new genre, in fact, by hybridizing practices, because, I mean, the interesting point here is also that everybody's done a fab website, and fake websites are all around, so that's not really surprising. So the materiality of the thing itself is, in fact, analog media. So and how far is the fact of remediating so efficient there? And then how far this authenticity, which is granted still by the paper press, here maybe has been the grant for getting to the stage of effectiveness.
Yeah, we talked about, yeah, every once in a while, with the idea of making fake website. All of us had done that before. But there is something about holding it in your hands, holding the paper in your hands, that just makes it feel real and hits people in a totally different way. And I think there's also a difference in cost. You know, you can make a fake website for about $16. Printing those papers costs $6,000. And the idea that someone would do that just to get a message out is a little bit harder to believe, right? Yeah.
I mean, there is a whole analog trend in a certain way, and you can see that even at Ars Electronica, they're if enormously not digital, but analog artworks being displayed again, which really deal with the very material of the thing. And instead of getting all together through a kind of data translation paradigm, you have more and more the specific fields that are coming back. And how far do you think that this is a kind of new practice that seems to be very current in tactical media practices right now?
Well, I think the thing with tactical media is you use whatever works best. So if we could make this message and have it impact as many people with like a bronze statue, like we'd be making bronze statues. It's whatever works and whatever's going to be the most effective. And you know, I kind of talked about how we got to the idea of a newspaper, and it's not really a rejection of anything. It's just practical. and immediate and tactile, you know, tactile and all these things. So it's, if there's a trend, I think it's maybe that the novelty of digital things is wearing off and we're looking at all the tools more evenly. Mm-hmm. At least it's that way for some of us.
Can you sum up? I mean, you have mentioned that there were many helpers and people that distributed, but also how many different kinds of media did you use?
Yeah. I mean, we use computers for sure. I mean, there were the wikis. There was, we made notes on paper, and all the design was done with design software. We had video. We made our own video news release that was a few days before the real thing was done, so we could shoot it, edit it, and have it ready the day of. And then we had those reaction shots. There was the website that had all that information on it. So that might be most of it, at least mm-hmm. the key parts.
You mentioned that there are many clones now coming around, mm-hmm. but how often do you think that you can repeat that, even in different formats, unless it loses again this efficient nature of this hybrid art project?
I'm looking forward to it when the day comes when people are like, oh, the activist made another newspaper, you know. hasn't gotten there yet, but then we'll figure something else out, you know. And so you gotta follow through in order for the idea to progress. And you know, people are doing it in different ways, and it definitely is not, the impact will trail off, but you know, then we'll see what happens next.
From a European perspective, I mean, it seemed that these Bush years were extremely beneficial for tactical art in the US.
The what?
The Bush years were extremely beneficial.
It's a shame though, you know? It's not a really great trade. I would take the, you know, I would trade back any day.
No, but I mean, the success also from groups like Critical Art Ensemble, the Yes Men that you mentioned, etc., is very much connected to the context within which it happens. So mm-hmm. in how far would you think that these years as well were a particular situation which probably created this kind of boom, and in how far will the tactical media scene now react to a kind of new situation?
Well, it's just as much needed, you know, and the nice thing about now is maybe we can spend a little bit less energy fighting things and trying to stop things, and instead trying to build things and start things. And that's the shame of that 8 years, is that there could have been a lot of progress made. There was, Seattle was just before, you know, and so then what could have happened in those 8 years if that was kept being built on? And so, you know, is it a reaction to that? I don't think activists will ever stop. You know, like, if there's a president now, they're not stopping. There's still, you know, there's still dissent. There's still a push to make things better. The nice thing is that we can work with a little bit instead of working against. So.
Okay, Steve.